The Cultured Meat Symposium is back in San Francisco on October 28th and 29th, 2022. This year, the theme of the event is creativity and commerce. Learn more and register at www.cms2022.com. Thanks for joining us on the Future Food Show. We're excited to have Trevor Williams as the guest for today's episode. Trevor Williams is a former high school agri-science teacher turned podcaster that started the Farm Traveler podcast back in 2019. Farm Traveler has one goal, that being to connect consumers with farmers, ranchers, and entrepreneurs in the agriculture industry. Trevor has published over 150 podcast episodes, educational videos, and farm tours on the Farm Traveler YouTube channel, and produces two other agriculture-focused podcasts. I've been a guest on the Farm Traveler myself and always enjoy speaking with Trevor. Let's jump right in. Thanks for joining us on the Future Food Show. We're really excited to have Trevor Williams on the show today. Trevor, welcome to the show.
Alex, great to chat with you again, man. It's always fun to be on the other side of the microphone, so this is super fun.
Absolutely. And for those of you who are listening, I was recently on Trevor's podcast, and it was actually quite a funny story on how we actually got acquainted.
Yeah, I was trying to find out information from my podcast, Farm Traveler, about like, hey, who can I interview that knows a thing or two about cultured meat? Because I know absolutely nothing about it. And so I shot out a tweet into the void. And then you tweeted back and I was like, hey, Alex, let's have a chat. And so you came on the podcast and really opened my eyes to everything cultured meat. And so it was great. You know, social media gets a bad rap, but sometimes it helps build great relationships. So here we are.
Well, one thing I'm really excited about this podcast episode is that I'd love to actually share with the audience a little bit about the world of podcasting as well. But before we get into that, let the audience know about your podcast, how it got started, and what it's really all about.
Yeah, man, that the podcasting rabbit hole is going to be super, super long. That's great. I always love chatting about that. But yeah, so I actually graduated from the University of Florida with a degree in agriculture education and communication. And so I taught for 2 years and then got super burnt out. And then I transitioned to like software work and did that. But I really missed being an active part in agriculture. And so I started a blog, which was just Farm Traveler. And then at about 2018, 2019 is kind of when the whole podcast boom started. And my wife was like, hey, you know, you should start a podcast. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know how hard it is, like what the barrier for entry is for that. And so I looked into it and it was a lot more simple than I thought. And I was like, hey, you know what? I can do this. And so started it. It was really simple. I first interviewed people, just kind of farmers and ranchers that I knew. The whole premise of the show, Farm Traveler, was, you know, I want to interview people, learn more about where our food comes from. And like, actually, you know, you hear this phrase a lot in agriculture. We want to bridge the gap between farmers and consumers. But really, I wanted to build relationships where farmers and consumers could support one another, really build trust. And like, if you're a consumer, you could support a farmer in your state or in your community, and kind of going off of that. And so it's been a really fun ride. I've interviewed people all over the US, Canada, the UK, Saudi Arabia, Australia. I interviewed one farmer in the UK. They actually have a milk vending machine. And this was one of our like earlier podcasts. And they, instead of like collecting it and shipping it off to a distribution company where it then goes to market, they actually have a processing facility on site where they put it in a vending machine. And then local villagers can come up and buy milk directly from the farm, which I think is super cool. So yeah, it's been super fun. I should probably touch base on this. The name Farm Traveler comes from my favorite show on Travel Channel, which was Booze Traveler. And so on there, the host, Jack Maxwell, travels around the country, around the world, interviewing people about like local spirits, local drinks. And we're actually lucky enough to have him on the show about a year and a half ago. So that was super fun. And talk with him about his background and his new endeavors and stuff like that. So that's kind of the whole spiel on the Farm Traveler podcast, I guess you could say.
Wow, that's cool. And I didn't know that the original kind of premise was kind of based off of another show. And did you say booze, like alcohol, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, his show, I don't think they're doing any more episodes, but I think it was like 4 or 5 episodes on Travel Channel. And he would travel like across the Florida Keys, Texas, Guatemala, China, and just kind of highlight anything that's like kind of interesting. I remember one really weird, not really weird, but one really interesting episode. He traveled to Mongolia and was traveling with some farmers there. And one of their favorite beverages was fermented cow's milk, or no, fermented yak milk, I think. And he was like, this sounds really weird, but he tried it. And he was like, it's actually pretty good. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Okay. So it's kind of cool. Like, he kind of sheds light on things that you might not know about and kind of the whole alcohol drink kind of sphere. So that was really fun.
Wow. That's cool. Well, we'll be able to link that episode specifically, as well as kind of, you know, the overall website, which is thefarmtraveler.com, in the show notes. And of course, anywhere you could find podcasts, the links will be in the show notes. So that's really cool. And I'm seeing now that you're close to 149, 150 episodes. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've done almost 150 like normal interview episodes. And then I've done a couple of other episodes, which are like Farm News Friday, or I did this segment about a year and a half ago. It was called Ag 101. And every couple of months, I would kind of take like a high concept thing like the food supply chain and kind of break it down, or even something like hydroponics or carbon sequestration and stuff like that. So kind of bigger episodes I would kind of put in the little Ag 101 context, or even Farm News Friday. But yeah, almost 150 episodes. It's weird. It doesn't feel like I've been doing it for about like 3 years. It feels like it's only been a couple of months, but it's been super fun. And so, you know, I'm hoping we get to do another 150 episodes, or, you know, even guesting on other podcasts, which is always super fun to get on other niche podcasts and share what's going on.
Well, it was an honor to be on the Farm Traveler podcast, and it's really exciting to have you here. I want to really ask you about, you know, really get this out of the way and ask you about the topic of cultured meat. You know, before that tweet, was that something that had ever come up when you were talking to farmers that are, you know, either, you know, cattle farmers or other type of farmers, any type of farmers? Did it ever come up before kind of that tweet or that time?
You know, honestly, it might have only come up once or twice. I would say the biggest thing right now is plant-based meats that are really coming up, because, I mean, they're really popular. In the past year or so, they've been surging. I mean, you know, you've got Impossible, Beyond Meat, all that other plant-based proteins. But yeah, I didn't really hear about it until a couple of months ago, which, I mean, being in agriculture, I've known it was a thing, but I really didn't know how far along it was, and that, you know, we're actually producing things that you can eat, like fake fish, or not fake fish, but like cell cultured fish or something, stuff like that.
And I like that correction there.
Yeah. I was like, nope, not fake meat. Which, I mean, honestly, that's still like a huge misconception. Like, this was a really funny thing. I posted on Instagram, you know, when I was promoting our episode that you were on. And I was like, hey, what do you guys think about cultured meat? Like, just asking followers and everybody on Instagram. And of course, you know, the hashtags always bring you anybody that follows that hashtag. And so I put a bunch of different interesting like meat, fake meat, cultured meat hashtag stuff on there just to kind of see what would happen. And a lot of people were like, I don't know. Like, I didn't know this was a thing. And so I feel like right now, at least from like the consumer perspective, that we're kind of at that point where we were a few years ago in terms of like plant-based dairy milk. Because at first consumers were like, I don't know, I don't really trust that. And now, you know, you see it everywhere. Oat milk, almond milk, everybody's much more accepted of it because, you know, we've been exposed to it. And so I feel like right now we're kind of at that point with cultured meat where consumers are like, I don't know, I just learned about it. But maybe in like 4 or 5 years, I really think it's going to be something that, oh yeah, like I had some cultured meat yesterday. So it's very interesting, this space, to kind of see how it evolves. That's for sure. And I mean, even when I had you on, I had no clue about all the processes and stuff that's been going on. So it's really interesting to kind of see, I don't know, how the technology is developing and really how viewpoints are slowly but surely changing on it.
You know, you brought up an interesting point that, you know, using like the fake meat hashtag actually kind of allowed people to think about it more or look into it more. And, you know, as an industry, we try not to use the terms like lab grown meat or fake meat, or, you know, even cultured meat or clean meat. You know, all these other terms that are being used are oftentimes are kind of dismissed. But at least in the data that we look at, you know, terms like artificial meat, synthetic meat, even fake meat, you know, these are the terms that actually people are using to try to learn more about these technologies. And if you search things like synthetic meat, you do actually end up going to some of these cultured meat companies. So it's interesting to kind of see that that actually brought about some reactions on Instagram.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting to kind of see how this terminology really affects things. I mean, I've interviewed a bunch of dairy farmers, for example, and I mean, I totally see their viewpoints, but they're like, you know, plant-based milk isn't milk. It's its own thing. It's almond milk or it's almond juice or oat juice or whatever you want to call it. And so I feel like a lot of people sometimes really get strung up on the phrases instead of actually like diving in and learning more about it. And I mean, yeah, it's very interesting to just kind of see like, oh, I think cultured meat is fake. I'm going to just Google fake meat and see what happens. And then maybe they might stumble upon plant-based meat or cultured meat and just kind of learn about that. So it's, I love just kind of, I don't know. I love the psychology behind food and phrases and stuff like that to kind of see how something like cultured meat, somebody is going to get really turned off by that. But then once they actually look into it and do research, they're like, oh, wait a minute. The context of this actually makes a lot of sense. Like, I get why it's cultured meat. I get that it's real meat being grown differently. Like, I understand it more. So it's, I feel like once you get past that kind of biased, you're golden. But I feel like that's the really hard part to do, which, I mean, that's kind of like everybody right now. You got to get past that biased.
You talk to people in, you know, that are farmers or in the farming and ag industry. You mentioned that plant-based meat is one of those trends that's kind of coming up. What are some other trends, you know, maybe not necessarily related to meat? What are some other trends that are coming up in this, you know, in the farming industry?
Oh, man, I would say, especially because of COVID, the whole direct to consumer thing has really been accelerated a quick little story, like around early 2020, you know, restaurants, everything started shutting down. Businesses were going under. The whole food supply chain was messed up. And for example, like if a restaurant has a contract with a farmer, that farmer is usually only going to sell that produce to that restaurant or to that grocery store. Well, when those restaurants shut down, those grocery stores shut down, there's really nowhere for that food to go. And a lot of people were saying like, oh, well, why don't they just donate it to food banks? Well, you know, if you're a farmer that has like 1,000 acres of squash, it's going to be really hard to donate hundreds of tons of squash to a single food bank or even just a couple dozen food banks. Like that's going to be really, really hard to do. And especially something like milk or meat where it's got to be refrigerated, there's a lot of barriers right there. Like a food bank is only going to have like one or two fridges, maybe a couple freezers. Like they can't fit all of that produce. And so what a lot of farms did, especially down here in Florida, I saw a lot of it. There was a squash and cucumber grower that was like, hey, the restaurants that I ship to are shut down, so I'm just going to open it up to consumers to drive in. So he was like, hey, on Saturday at 9 a.m., come in, get a box of squash and cucumbers for like $10. And it was like, I don't know, 20 or 30 cucumbers and squash per box. Like it was a large amount of food. And he shared a picture on Facebook and there was like a 2-mile long line of cars ready to buy directly from him. And so
drive-through style.
yeah, drive-through style, exactly. And I mean, it was so great because he is like making more money because he's not having to go through distribution companies, processing companies, and sign contracts with everybody. And consumers are getting cheaper produce directly from a farmer, which is amazing. And I thought that was so cool. And there's so many businesses that did that because of COVID, not because they wanted to capitalize on it, but because they had to do it or else they were going to go out of business. Like they did it as a means of survival. And there've been so many companies now that have really instead of just changing their business model, they are doing that on top of it. So they might still be selling to restaurants and hotels and other tourist destinations or grocery stores, for example, but they're also capitalizing on selling direct to consumers, whether that's through subscription models or UPIC operations and stuff like that. So it's been really cool that, I mean, the whole COVID was horrible and it's still going on, you know, but there's been this huge win for farmers and consumers because, I mean, you had a means, you had to do it or your business was going to go under. So it happened and now it's been a success story that really I've seen throughout the United States and even the world. So that's been a trend that I've seen lately that's been pretty amazing to follow.
That's interesting. And I think you said it well, that it wasn't just the farmers that were making that change to be able to do that, but it was also a shift in consumer mindset to say, you know what, I can do this now, or I should do this now, because, you know, things are changing now. I'm scanning QR codes on menus and all sorts of things. People were more willing to integrate with technology to kind of get what they wanted. So I think that makes it's a very interesting point. And traditionally, when you're selling to some of these big buyers, they don't give you a very high price for it, and they want really large volumes, and they're actually very picky about what they're looking for. So, you know, do you think, you know, we've often heard that these small time farmers are starting to get weeded out, right, for lack of a better term. Do you think that this kind of shift in technology, maybe due to COVID, will give these small farmers another chance?
Oh, absolutely. I really think it'll give them a chance, because I mean, it's really come about, like, you really, once you find your market, once you find your ideal customer basis, you'll be fine. And I mean, especially as people are really trying to buy local, locally sourced meat, locally sourced produce, I think as smaller farms are really able to kind of use any sort of technology that's available now, it'll really help them be a success story. And I mean, even, I forget the name of it, but there's some app coming out in a couple of months. I was doing research and I saw it, but the app basically, it categorizes every farm around you, and it tells you if it's like, if it has any agritourism opportunities for you. And so that technology is huge. Like, if you want to go and pick blueberries at a small mom and pop blueberry farm, and if they're able to find this app and put it on there, you can do it. And I mean, that's huge for the consumer. It's huge for the farmer. And I mean, it's been really cool to kind of see, I guess, just kind of the meshing between Silicon Valley developing all these new technologies and a lot that's been developed in the past couple of years focused on agriculture and really how consumers are doing that. I mean, like, take Instagram, for example. Because of that, you can literally go on Instagram, like we were talking earlier, look up any hashtag. Like, for example, let's say I want to look up avocados. So I look up an avocado hashtag and I can see avocados being grown in the field and like what it looks like on avocado farm. Like, that's a huge tool. And if you combine that with maybe that UPIC operation app where you can find local agritourism, that's going to be phenomenal. So I can find fruit, meat that I like that's local, and I can go there and I can learn about it and I can support that farmer. Like, that's huge. And I think more and more technology is going to be developed as we kind of focus that. And especially as both consumers and farmers want this relationship right now, which I think has been really cool.
It's very interesting about UPIC specifically, because one of the reasons I think a lot of farms don't do UPIC is because of the liability, right? They're, you know, we don't know what kind of insurance to get. But if this app kind of, you know, kind of like your Airbnb comes with insurance, so you feel safe to kind of rent out your place, if this app also provides like that insurance kind of safety net, I think this could be huge. That's super cool.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's a huge thing. Like, nobody wants to have a goat farm and then you have consumers out and then the goats trample them. I mean, that's no good. That's a lawsuit waiting to happen. I mean, even think about the tractors, the trailers, if you do hay rides, all the thousands of dollars of machinery, like that's a lawsuit waiting to happen if something goes wrong. And so I don't know if that app in particular has stuff like that, but I'm sure it would have to. Just at least something that's like, hey, if you want to partake, you've got to have some sort of insurance. Here's what you can do. Here's where you can go. So yeah, I mean, that would be a huge, huge thing. I actually interviewed somebody a few weeks ago. They're out in Jacksonville. They're called Congaree and Pin, and they're a UPIC operation, agritourism hotspot. And they actually do goat hikes where you can go out there, see their goats, and go out on hikes with the goats, which, I mean, it's so cool. I would pay like a great deal of money to go on a hike with a goat at a cool farm. That's such a cool premise. And so a lot of people have been doing that lately, which I think is phenomenal.
That is cool. And yeah, I would pay to do that too. That sounds awesome. So, you know, a big group of our audience is on the animal welfare side, pursuing plant-based diets. And when you look at organic farms, a lot of these organic methods of kind of creating organic produce requires things like fish fertilizer and really kind of non-vegan things. Can you comment on, you know, how that kind of is a dynamic? Has anybody, you know, talked about that? Is that something that has come up?
Oh, yeah. That, man, that's a huge one. I had an animal science professor at UF, and he said, he was like, you know what? Everybody thinks that the real world is like Disney, where animals talk, they sing, they're completely, like, you know, sentient, they could talk, everything like that. And I mean, that's cool. And I mean, anytime you talk about, you know, people that are organic or plant-based, it's all about taking care of the animals and making sure they're, you know, fat and happy. And I totally get that. Like, I don't think anybody in traditional agriculture, and especially anybody that really respects their meat, would disagree with that. Like, even if you eat meat, you should have the utmost respect, the utmost care for that animal. But yeah, I mean, especially when it comes to organic, like a lot of people think it's just, it just grows naturally in the field. And like people are just going out and foraging for organic celery or organic garlic and stuff like that. But there's a bunch of really good posts that you'll see from farmers that grow organic. And they're like, you know what? We grow organic because we think it's more in tune with nature. But the reality is we still have pests to take care of, whether or to eliminate, whether that's bugs or rabbits or crows or anything like that. So to ensure that we have a safe food supply for humans, sometimes we've got to take care of animals, and that sucks. Like, I don't think you'll find a single farmer out there that will say it doesn't suck. Like, it does. And I mean, that's honestly just a fact of the matter. And I mean, it's interesting because of things like vertical farming, where you grow crops indoors away from pests, and then even things like cultured meat, we could potentially eventually get away from that, get away from actually having to take care of pests, to take care of insects and stuff like that. And so, I mean, I think just because somebody has, just because maybe they have an organic diet or plant-based or anything like that, it doesn't mean that their diet is going to be cruelty-free. And I mean, it's just kind of a fact of the matter. It's not making anybody look bad. We've got to understand that, you know, we as humans, we cannot create our own food supply. We can't create our own energy. And I actually saw, so there's a show on Netflix called Chef's Table, and it does a phenomenal job. They basically go around the world and they go into the kitchens of Michelin star chefs, and they kind of just see how they got their start, their backgrounds and stuff like that. And there was this chef in, I think, Brazil. And he was talking about how he had this beautiful quote, and I'm going to totally butcher the quote, but it was something along the lines of, every time you eat, it's involved in the circle of life. Like, for example, whether you take a strawberry or a beef cattle, like a steak, anytime you are ingesting food, you are eating something that at some point was alive. They created nutrients themselves, and we processed it into something that we can eat so we can have our own energy, so we can do stuff. And I thought that was really cool, because a lot of people don't really think about that. They just think as plants, you know, don't have feelings, aren't alive and stuff like that, but they are. I mean, for example, that chemical smell after grass is cut is a pheromone given off by grass. And it's the grass basically saying like, hey, we're being attacked, come help us. So grass is alive. If grass is alive, I'm pretty sure strawberries are alive, or bananas or whatever. So it's this whole thing. And I'm sure I'm rambling, because this is something that I think a lot about, that a lot of people kind of have mixed emotions on. But I don't know. It's very interesting, because anytime we eat, there's going to be some sort of sacrifice there. And I mean, whether you're plant-based, keto, organic, whatever, if you're on the carnivore diet, whatever. So I think the important thing here, though, is just do your research and don't food shame anybody. Like, whatever anybody's diet is, whatever their dietary guidelines is, don't shame it. Just do your own research, as long as, you know, from factual, good cited resources and stuff like that. So yeah, what do you think about it? I'd love to get your thoughts on it too.
Well, I was going to say, we can definitely open up this can of worms, or maybe can of strawberries.
Yeah, there you go. This is a big old can of strawberries.
You know, I think for me, and for anybody listening, I've talked to a couple people within the industry specifically about this. But for me, you know, within the animal welfare movement, there is this idea of, you know, the term is sentientism or something like that. And it's essentially that, you know, every sentient being, you know, should be on this kind of equal playing field. And the discussion often comes up when it is related to, actually, mostly specifically bugs, right? And the idea is like, is killing a dog the same as killing a cow, the same as killing a fly, right? And the idea is that, you know, these are all living sentient beings and they're on the same playing field. But I think that's something that I'd love to, you know, well, one, I'd love to get your opinion, but two, I'd love to kind of, you know, if you're listening to this, give us your feedback. Like, what do you think? Because, you know, when you go out for a drive, you could actually be killing a lot of animals, a lot of bugs on the way to wherever you're going. And there's this fine balance of living and being able to be kind to the creatures around you. If you actually dig a little bit deeper and be very specific, it's very hard to do things without killing any animals, right? So having them all on this equal playing field, I think, is very tricky. And I think that's the discussion I'd love to bring up. But I mean, I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good point too, because I mean, at the same time, like, you know, if killing a dog is the same as killing a cow, is the same as killing a bug, like, what about if you're vegan and you don't eat cows? Well, you have a leather purse, or you have makeup, or you have marshmallows. Like, I mean, animal products are so ingrained into what we do now, whether that's even just our products, making plastic or whatever. And so, I mean, I think it's fine to use those products, but the thing is, as long as the animals are cared for. I mean, there's a great psychologist named Temple Grandin, which you might know about. A lot of people know about her. She is a phenomenal scientist and animal behaviorist. And the amazing thing about her story, I looked her up on Google just to double check everything, but she actually has autism, but for, I don't know, like, she's 74 years old. So for like 40, 50 years, she has been just spreading awareness over how important it is to care for animals before we process them, before we turn them into beef or leather or whatever. And it's so phenomenal just listening to her story and just kind of talking to her about, you know, we changed a lot in agriculture so we could really focus on the animal psychology to make sure that they are happy and healthy. Because the thing is, if those animals aren't happy and healthy, they're not going to produce. They're not going to grow. They're not going to weigh the specific amount they should before harvest or before slaughter and stuff like that. So just as much as you've got to care for plants in your fields, you've also got to care for the animals in your fields so that they can produce, so that they can grow. And so, I mean, I think it's totally fine that, you know, we eat animals, that we have products that have animals in them. But no matter what, like, whether it's here in the United States or Australia or Brazil, we've got to make sure we're doing it in a kind manner. We're taking care of them, but also kind of along the big picture, we've also got to do it in a very sustainable way. Because I mean, like, you'll hear stories of like Brazil, where they're cutting down the rainforest to put up more beef feed operations or cattle finishing operations. So I don't think we should do that. Like, we should make sure that we're doing it in a careful manner, in tune with nature, like rotational grazing or something like that, where we're caring for the animals, we're caring for the land, we're really caring for everything and not, you know, just producing as much as we can. Like, we've got to do it in a very, very careful manner.
This is super interesting because, so I've looked into Temple Grandin and the idea of animal welfare. And, you know, to be honest, when I heard about Temple Grandin's kind of we could call them advancements in animal welfare, it was a little bit shocking to me, because to me, I was coming into this with, you know, without experience in the agriculture space. And to me, kind of making sure that, for example, a lamb is maybe stunned to be killed, right? Or maybe a swift kill versus a painful death, right? To me, that was actually not animal welfare, right? Because I felt like, sure, it's, if you're gonna do it anyways, then it's better to do it quick or, you know, painless as possible. But that's where I kind of realized that within this segment, there's, you know, animal rights, and then there's animal welfare, where Temple Grandin falls into animal welfare, where, you know, you implement these safe practices. I think another example here is cage-free, you know, eggs, right? Whereas like these chickens, even though they're not in battery cages anymore, they're still in horribly confined spaces. And so I think if there is this kind of this line, right, where I would say kind of I fit on this line is, you know, what we see in animal agriculture, I guess industrialized animal agriculture, where you have, you know, thousands of, you know, tens of thousands of cows, and they all go to slaughter in these either big machines or factories. I would say that needs this, you know, huge radical change. But then again, I've spoken to farmers where they have a very small farm with just a few head of cattle, and it's completely regenerative. You know, I feel like that could be the future. Whereas, you know, saying animal welfare is still kind of stunning the lamb before it goes into, you know, this huge slaughter facility. I feel like, you know, that is something that should change. I'd love to kind of get your opinion on maybe, you know, more general animal agriculture. Industrialized animal agriculture. Do you think we need to change it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really do, because I agree with a lot of the points you're saying. I heard a farmer, this was years ago on one of the podcast episodes. She said that there was this old time farmer in her county that would always say, like, consumers don't need to know what goes on a farm. Like, they don't need to know what happens. They just need to get their food. But I really feel like that was the perspective centuries ago, because now, you know, especially with social media, it's so easy to show what's going on. And so for the past couple of decades, because of that, because of the internet, I feel like more people are really, they've gotten aware of what happens, like, you know, how we might slaughter cows, sheep, how the growing conditions of pigs or chickens are. And I mean, the thing is, like, sure, there's a lot of improvements that agriculture can make. Absolutely. There's a lot of improvements that they have already made, especially animal agriculture. But I mean, kind of what you're getting at, like, there's so many people that rely on farmers. Like, I think it's something like the average farmer feeds like 45 or 55 people a day, because so many people are removed. And because of that removal, farmers have got to do so much to produce so much. Like, there's so many things they've been doing for 40 or 50 years that they just did to answer, you know, we've got to have X amount of cows processed this year so that we can supply, you know, our distribution company or whatever. Like, we've got to meet those numbers. And to do that, we've got to do X, Y, and Z. And so I think there's been this shift the past decade or so where, you know, states like California, for example, are banning the use of farrowing crates, for example, for pigs. So farrowing crates, for example, there's gestation crates and farrowing crates. So gestation crates are when pigs give birth. And basically, it doesn't allow the mom to move around. The reason being, because if the mom could just walk around the pigs, she would most likely crush the piglets, because, you know, she's not paying attention. The piglets get in the wrong way. And a mama pig is a really big pig, and the piglets are really tiny. So, I mean, that's a very simple squash. But, I mean, that sucks. Like, are they doing it for the well-being of the mom and the piglets? Yeah, but it really sucks for the pig being in that small confinement area. And even, like, cage-free eggs, it's great that they're not, you know, in cages anymore, because with caged hens, they're in such a small area that there's, like, three chickens in there. And the conditions are just really bad, but, you know, they're doing it to meet the quota of getting so many eggs produced. But I'm sure there could be so many more better ways that we could do it. And I mean, I think the thing is, especially with the rise of technology and just more people being involved and really being vocal, I think that we can really have some really good answers here. And so I think the thing is, at least a shift that we all kind of need to do is not really just kind of do a blame game, but just be like, hey, why is this happening? How could we improve it? And I've seen a lot of farmers do that. I've seen a lot of people, a lot of consumers do that. I mean, you know, there are some organizations like PETA, for example, they're really on the animal rights side of things. So most of them are thinking that, you know, animals all need to be free, like even dogs and cats, we don't need to have as pets. But a lot of, I feel like 99.99% of people out there are like, you know what, it's okay. Whether you have dogs or cats as pets, or if you eat beef or sheep or whatever, we just need to make sure that they are all safe, they're all happy, they're all healthy, they're all cared for. And so I think as we continue to develop new technologies and more people are aware about what goes on at a farm and what we've been doing in the past versus what we're doing now, I think it'll be interesting to see. And especially, I really hope it drives more people to be actually farmers and ranchers, where you can have, you know, a buddy down the road that raises 20 cattle in a very regenerative manner, and he just sells to his friends and family. Like, I think that's phenomenal, whether you're in, you know, New York, Florida, Mexico, wherever. Like, if you can do that, if more people start producing, I think you'll see this whole system change, hopefully. Yeah, which I think is going to be really cool, because I've seen a lot of people slowly but surely go back into the farming side of things. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I would say a lot more people, especially, again, because of COVID, they're like, you know what, I'm going to quit my day job. I want to go work on a farm, or I want to go work on a ranch, or I want to do something outside. Like, I want to do something that's more in tuned with nature, or something that, you know, I feel more primal toward. So I don't know. I think it's a very interesting thing, but I think more people need to be willing to have this discussion instead of just turning off to it and just being like, no, I don't want to talk about it. I'm a rancher. I know what I'm doing. Or I'm an animal rights activist. I know that what you're doing is 100% wrong. Like, I think we all just need to be a little bit more willing to have those discussions, even if they are a little bit uncomfortable at times.
I like that. And I think what you did a very good job of shedding light on is that it is a very complex issue. And I think I'm reminded of a quote from a former guest, Josh Balk, who kind of said that, you know, there is no executive of a meat company that goes to their office and thinks, how can we kill more animals? Like, nobody's thinking that,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, maybe they have to make business decisions that end up going that way, but nobody actively wants to do that. So I think that's important to note. There's two more things I want to talk about. One thing you touched on was, you know, we could be solving this, you know, these problems by having more people interested in farming. And for, you know, in the past, it was a very kind of exciting job opportunity to become a farmer. But nowadays, especially smaller farms, has become increasingly difficult. Do you think that's getting popular again? Is you know, being a farmer is something that, you know, somebody is, you know, on a small scale is it's getting popular to do?
I think so. I mean, you know how fashion kind of comes in trends, like, you know, I don't know, bell-bottom jeans or whatever. Now it seems like all the celebrities are wearing them now, when they used to not, until, like, I don't know, it's the 70s and now it's the 20s. I don't know. So fashion's weird, but I feel like maybe careers are kind of that way too. Like, it was really cool maybe a decade ago to go into the whole tech business, to get an IT job or a software development job. Well, now people are kind of, they may still be doing those jobs, but maybe they're geared towards agriculture, they're geared towards farming or whatever. I mean, maybe they inherited some land and they want to go work that land, which I think is phenomenal. But I think one of the big issues is that, you know, the population's increasing, the number of homes and communities are increasing. So the number of farms and available farmland has been increasingly going down, which of course is going to make things really tough for producing food, but also for people that want to be active in agriculture. And so I think even with that, there's still a bunch of people out there that, you know, have started gardening, or they've started going to farmers markets, or maybe even just going to UPIC operations like we talked about earlier, where they can have maybe a small role, but still a role in their food. And so I think hopefully that trend continues, and hopefully more and more people can, you know, start homesteading or something like that. I mean, I know my wife and I, for example, we live in a community, but we can't, you know, have livestock, but I really want to get chickens. And so I've looked it up in the bylaws. You can have chickens as long as it's okay with your neighbors. So I think that'd be something super fun that we could do down the road. I mean, we wouldn't be quote unquote farmers, but we would have some sort of connection with our food. We could give eggs to our neighbors. I mean, some of our neighbors are super chill, but we have some older, ornery neighbors, so I'm pretty sure we wouldn't tell them that we have chickens. But luckily, I have looked it up, and there are several varieties of chickens that don't, you know, cluck. They're very quiet, so I'm going to have to get those. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to kind of see that people, you know, they want to go outside. They want to have different careers. They want to do something different. They want to do something. They want to rebel against the machine, I guess you could say. They want to, I don't know, be more natural, be more outside. So we'll see how it goes. I'm very excited to see what happens.
Yeah. And I like the idea, or the example of, you know, the chicken in the backyard, because, you know, those chickens, I'm sure, will have a really fantastic life compared to the chickens and even the cage-free eggs. And so it's interesting to think it's not just, you know, about people getting into smaller farming situations or farming jobs. It could be a huge range of solutions that end up contributing to really better practices overall.
Oh yeah. I mean, now imagine you live in like a big city, and maybe, well, not like a big city, but like a little community, and like maybe every three or four neighbors has three or four chickens, something like that. I'm sure that would be more than enough eggs to supply for that area. And I mean, it's not like we need to do it to eliminate chicken farmers, like absolutely not. But that would free up a lot of poultry growers, whether they're growing just chickens or growing for eggs. It would free them up because they wouldn't have to meet a quota. And so they could change up their operation a little bit to focus more on growing, I don't know, some very specialty eggs or specialty chicken or something like that, to where they're not focused on numbers. They're able more to focus on the quality of those chickens. Because I mean, you know, like for example, I've been following a farmer in Canada. His name is Pete, and he's got a huge pullet operation where they grow chicks until they're big enough to go to a facility where they can then, like, you know, pack on the pounds until they're processed. So he has them for, I think, about 6 to 8 weeks. So if more people started growing chickens at home for eggs and for meat, he would have a smaller quota he would have to meet. So he could really focus on small flocks instead of these huge flocks that are like tens of thousands of birds or something like that. So it'd be really interesting. We could really lighten the load on the agriculture industry where they could do more research, more focus on things that are being done instead of just, you know, the sheer massive amount of volume that they're trying to meet right now, which is really hard. That's a really hard balance between meeting your quota, having high numbers of items versus the care and the quality of the animals. So I think that'll be interesting. I mean, I think it'd be fun to have more people, have more chickens in the backyards, have more cows. I think that'd be super fun. I mean, you know, more kind of along the lines of how things naturally should be.
I want to shift the conversation towards indoor farming and kind of having, you know, maybe vertical farming from a standpoint in urban areas. I want to say that, you know, it seems like, you know, we've been reading about these indoor farms or vertical farms or, you know, highly, you know, farms and vertical farms in highly dense urban areas for a long time. And there are a few that are starting to pop up, but it seems like it's not moving fast enough, or at least that's how I feel. Can you elaborate or comment on why this is not kind of a bigger deal and we're still kind of relying on farms in the way that we do?
Yeah, so I've done a bunch of research on indoor farming because I think vertical farms, indoor farming is phenomenal, and I really think it's kind of the future. But the thing is, of all these multi-million or billion-dollar companies like Arrow Farms, for example, I don't think more than like one or two have actually turned a profit, because right now they're really just investing huge amounts of money to build the facilities, to develop the technology. For example, I think Arrow Farms, they partnered with a lab that is then developing technology for drones. So you're going to have these huge indoor growing facilities with like two or three stories worth of vertical farms. So it's going to be really hard for a person to climb up those systems to check all the plants. So they're developing drones that can fly around to check the crops to see how they're doing, if any plants are malnourished or something like that. And so I think the problem is that we're still kind of in that infancy, the infancy phase, where we know it can work, we know it's viable, but maybe we're trying to focus too hard on making it the end all be all right now. Instead of just making it an additional way to grow food, I feel like a lot of investors are betting for this to replace traditional agriculture, which I don't think is ever going to happen. And I saw this really, really interesting research article basically comparing different vertical farming techniques versus row crops. And, you know, a lot of thing with row crops, you hear that there's like a lot of evaporation of the water, a lot of chemicals being used. But in terms of sustainability and the impact on the environment, it's actually more efficient to grow row crops, because vertical farming, in terms of producing the materials to, you know, for the building, for the hydroponic systems, for the drones even, and even lighting the building, lighting or powering up the water pumps and everything, that still has a much greater impact on the environment, the energy demands, because the energy demands are much greater than the input demands for traditional agriculture. And so I think if those people in charge of vertical farming change the shift, instead of using it to, we're gonna do this and just completely put traditional agriculture out of place, that's not gonna happen. They need to change the shift and just say, hey, this is a very sustainable way once we get it down perfectly. let's go ahead and start producing it. And let's just focus on, you know, showing everybody what it can do and bringing products to consumers instead of just showing what it could potentially do. Like, people really want to see the product. Like, for example, I think Arrow Farms right now, they're in New York, but you can only buy them within like an hour radius or something, which is super small. And that's a multi-billion dollar company. Yet, I mean, they've got all this infrastructure, they've got all this investment, but they haven't turned a profit. And it's been very interesting to see where that's been going. And so I think we really need to change the shift a little bit and kind of just say, hey, this is another way to do things. Check it out.
That's right. And there is an indoor farm near where I live called Gotham Greens. And, you know, I don't see their product. You know, I've seen it on store shelves before, but it's not that accessible as you might think. So it's definitely interesting. Well, Trevor, the time has flown by very quickly once again. You can learn more about Trevor on LinkedIn and also the podcast at thefarmtraveler.com. Trevor, do you have any last insights for our audience today?
Man, I would just say continue listening to the Cultured Meat podcast, the Future Food podcast. I mean, I've been binging your episodes lately, and I think it's so cool because your listeners are really getting a behind-the-scenes look at an evolving technology that in like, I don't know, 3-4 years is going to be all over the place. And so I think you guys are giving them a great behind-the-scenes look and really just kind of stay the course and kind of see what's been going on. And yeah, I've been enjoying your episodes, and it was great to come back on and chat with you. It was fun having you on my podcast. So always fun to collaborate. So excited to see where your show goes, man. And also excited to see where Cultured Meat goes. As soon as someplace here in North Florida has something where I can try some cultured meat, I'm going to beeline over there and I'm going to try it. I'm going to let you know how it is.
I think it'll happen sooner than you think.
I hope so. Fingers crossed.
Trevor, thank you so much for the kind words, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
This program was produced by H Media. See you soon.